Welcome to the FCC. I'm Anna Fenton, as many of you already know. We're very lucky today to have a truly inspirational speaker. So in a few moments, May will come up and begin her address. But first of all, a few matters of housekeeping. First of all, please remember to switch your mobile phones back on when you leave. Thank you very much. Otherwise, we will have unauthorized interruptions. Now, there's a couple of events coming up that I'm sure you'll be interested in. Next week, on Monday the 26th, we have Johan Bjorksten, who's going to be, he's the chairman of Eastway, what are they called? Relations, yeah. And he's going to be talking about the challenges of promoting foreign brands in nationalistic China next Monday. Then on May the 3rd in the evening, we have a cocktail talk from Graham Earnshaw talking about the Great Walk of China as his journey on foot from Shanghai to Tibet. I hope you'll be able to attend that. He's written a book, which is a photo book, which will be available that day. And then we have a change to the advertised schedule. Mark O'Neill will not now be talking next week. He's been moved to June the 2nd, talking about the greatest NGO in China, the Suu Kyi. So that will now be at the beginning of June, and you'll receive notification about that. Okay, well, here we have May Lee, who I think any of you who are female journalists and who have worked your way up in Asia will be all too familiar with her story. It's one of struggling against an often, hate to say it, sexist and rather old-fashioned environment. But she came right through up the ranks of TV, CNN, CNBC, to have her own talk show, The May Lee Show, and start her own production company. And she's going to tell you about the trials and tribulations of that, as life as an entrepreneur. And she's just written a new book, which she's promoting at the moment, and we'll be having a launch tonight at The Coast in Soho. It's a bar and restaurant, I think, May, isn't it? Yeah. So without further ado, May Lee.
Okay, yes, we have to lower the mic because I'm so small. Well, thank you so much for inviting me to this event, and I thank you all for taking your time out from your busy schedules to be here, so I really appreciate it. As Anna mentioned, I just wrote a book that sort of is an account of my journalistic entrepreneurial journey so far, and the subtitle is called It All Begins With Passion. The reason why is because I'm a firm believer that you have to follow what you're most passionate about in life, or else I say, what's the point? Got to be inspired that way. And I have my own philosophy that I came up with, and it's kind of throughout the theme of the book. I call it the four P's for success. The first, of course, being passion. The second being perseverance. The third being persuasion. And the final being patience. I'm going to sort of talk about each of those elements throughout my talk today and give you examples of how that kind of played out in my career so far. But so for me, defining passion came a little bit earlier in my life when I was in university. I was your typical Asian kid who thought I was going to be a doctor because that's what you're supposed to do. And so it was kind of a struggle between what I thought I was supposed to do versus what I felt passionate about. But I really fought that because I wanted to be that conservative kid. So I decided I was going to be pre-med, like a nice Korean girl should be. Either that or it was going to be law school. Funnily enough, though, I was one of the Asian kids who was very bad at science and math. In fact, chapter one of my book is called I'm Asian, but I can't do science and math. So let me read you an excerpt of the struggles that I went through. To describe my experiences as a pre-med student as horrific would be putting it mildly. Chemistry was bad enough, but then there was physics. Physics? What the? Oh, and don't forget I had to forge through math classes as well. Let's put it this way. I can liken my first year and a half of college to wrapping my entire body in duct tape and then having strips of it ripped off every hour on the hour. Yes, it was that excruciating. Obviously, this was not my path. So I had to really dig down and ask myself, okay, then what is, you know, what is your passion? What do you like doing? What do you get excited about? So when I answered those questions, it was you love writing, speaking, and visual creativity. So television journalism must be your calling. It's as if I had never wanted to do anything else in my future. Like falling in love, I knew that journalism was the one. I was too green and young to know it at the time, but what I felt was true passion, the first of the four P's. Passion would be something I would continue to discover and cultivate over the years. Easier said than done, though, to say that this is what you want to do and then actually fulfill it. Breaking into journalism, as some of you know, being journalists is not an easy thing. It's quite competitive. And at the time, for me, I was a victim of bad timing, trying to get my first television job. And it's because it was the height of something called Japan bashing. So my search for a job as a television reporter couldn't have come at a worse time. It was the height of Japan bashing in America. People were infuriated over car dumping by Japanese automakers and the buying up of property and true blue American landmarks such as Rockefeller Plaza and Pebble Beach Golf Course. They were being bought by wealthy Japanese. No television station, and I mean not one, wanted to hire an Asian face. It was a liability. I sent dozens of tapes to the tiniest towns in America before I realized what was going on. But instead of giving up, I relied on my second P, which was perseverance. I thought of different ways to make myself known to news directors around the country. One harebrained idea I had was to wrap my nondescript videotape in bright pink plastic wrapping so that it might shock someone into picking it up. I don't know if that worked, to be honest, because I sent out about 60 tapes to different cities that I had never even heard of in the United States, places I would definitely never choose to live in. And then I finally got my break. A news director in Redding, California called me and offered me a job as a reporter, which was thrilling and both frightening at the same time. For me, it was a job that required me to be a one-man band, which meant I was, you know, shooting, editing, reporting, driving, everything that I had to do on my own. But it was the break that I needed. I then went on to Dayton, Ohio, which was my hometown, to work as an anchor and a reporter. There I faced some more challenges, and some of it had to do with racism. Dayton, Ohio is middle America. So me being an Asian female on television was something that people were not used to seeing, and some people did not like very much. So here is an example of a caller who asked for me to talk to me on the phone. This is the caller. This is a Midwestern accent, okay. Is this May Lee? Yes, it is. May I help you? Yeah. What are you doing on TV here? Excuse me? We don't want your kind on TV here. You should just go back to where you came from. Ah, well, I'm sorry you feel that way, but just so you know, I was born in Columbus, Ohio, and grew up in Dayton, so I am where I came from. You know what I mean. No, I really don't. Thank you for your call. You know, not easy when you're 24 years old, right? But this was, you know, something that really taught me a lesson that, you know, about, again, perseverance, and just living out your dream of following your passion regardless. This was a challenge that actually made me stronger. It didn't make me cower in the corner. It just made me realize that I had to fight a little bit harder for what I wanted. After Dayton, Ohio, I then got a big break to come overseas for the first time. NHK recruited me to go to Japan and work for a business show. And then a couple of years later, CNN Tokyo asked me to become their correspondent in Tokyo. And that was something that I had never imagined. But I was still young at the time, and so they wanted to sort of ease me into the process of becoming a CNN correspondent. It was supposed to be a very relaxed, slow adjustment into the network. But my timing as a journalist was impeccable. You know, journalists, we love bad news and horrible events because that's what we'd like to cover. I seem to always be at the right place at the right time. So the slow induction actually didn't happen because before I even started at CNN, there was a Kobe earthquake in 1995. I literally was sent over immediately with no trial, no getting used to anything. Nobody even knew I was a CNN correspondent. And it was literally trial by fire. And then after that, 2 months later, it was a sarin gas attack on the Tokyo subways. It was unprecedented what was happening in Japan. And that was yet another story that, you know, we all didn't expect, and it gave me unbelievable exposure and experience at the same time to sort of be a true global journalist. And then after that, this is all the same year, folks, a story in Okinawa broke out that nobody was really talking about at the time, but my team happened to see a tiny little article about it in the Stars and Stripes, which is the US military newspaper. And it was disturbing to us. It was about an accusation of a 12-year-old schoolgirl who had been raped by three US Marines. But literally, the article was this big, and nobody else was talking about it. We decided, well, you know, maybe this is something worth investigating. So we did, and we realized that this was a much bigger story. So we decided to do the story, and this is something that really struck me when we put it on the air. I was the first to report the story to viewers outside of Japan, and the overwhelming reaction it received taught me a valuable lesson in the responsibilities of a journalist. The day after my report aired on CNN, the US State Department, which had remained silent over the issue, came out with an official apology and promised a thorough investigation of the alleged crime in order to bring those responsible to justice. None of us had any idea that the incident would snowball into one of the biggest events to impact US-Japan relations in recent history. It went beyond the crime itself. The rape of the schoolgirl represented decades of tension between local Okinawans and the US military. I should add a footnote. This led to a year of negotiations between the US and Japan over the troops that were based in Okinawa, and they promised to realign the US troops. 10 plus years later, they still haven't done it. And they're still apparently working on it. So this is, you know, an ongoing story that I can't believe that I covered that long ago, and yet it's still not resolved. But it did teach me, like I said before, the responsibility of being a journalist, that one thing we say on the air could affect foreign policy. And so for someone still kind of young at the time, it was a very valuable lesson. After CNN Tokyo, I was then sent to Hong Kong, right before the handover. Yet again, I was very lucky and fortunate to be at a place where there was a major story going on. So it was an incredible opportunity to cover a historic event. And after that, it was, again, more and more stories. Asian financial crisis a couple months later, downfall of Suharto, natural disasters. It was one thing after another. But I soon started feeling unsure about where I was and what I was doing. I felt like I wanted a little bit more fulfillment with my direction. And I wanted to reignite the passion I had again. And therefore, I decided, all right, then what does that mean? Where do I need to go? And I heard about this new channel that was going to be started by Oprah Winfrey called Oxygen Media. And it was, I mean, something just snapped in my head, and I'm like, oh my God, that is where I need to go. Because the idea of this channel was everything that Oprah represents, women's empowerment, inspiration, covering stories that were about positive things, positive events, making a difference in people's lives. Luckily, I was hired to be a host for that channel, and it was probably one of the most overwhelming experiences I've ever had in my career, being part of a startup of that nature, and being surrounded by such creativity and people really wanting to sort of change the face of media through women's entertainment. So nobody had really tried to do that before with such focus. One of my biggest gets when I was at Oxygen was to get an exclusive interview with Monica Lewinsky. This was, of course, after the whole scandal had broken out. And the only interview that she had given to somebody was Barbara Walters. And after that, she refused to give any more exclusive interviews. But we tried. We said, all right, well, you know, maybe she'll listen and maybe she'll want to talk to us, thinking that there was no chance that we would get her. But so we had a meeting with her and her very tough publicist. At the time, she had just started a handbag business, so we suggested focusing on her new business and her new life post-scandal. I tried to be professional in the meeting, but also I wanted to be as real as possible. No phoniness, no false promises, no game playing. I wanted Monica to trust me. And this is where the third of the four P's I was always trying to apply to my life kicked in, persuasion. My approach of being honest and sincere proved persuasive. The next day, the publicist called with good news. Monica had agreed to a lengthy sit-down interview in New York, a visit to the garment district where she often purchases materials for her bags, and, the big bonus, a weekend visit to New Orleans where her small bag factory was located. My access to Monica would be unprecedented. This was pretty thrilling for me just because it was such a big story, and she literally opened up to me. She told me things that I never expected her to say, and she was quite honest about herself and who she was. And believe it or not, folks, this jaded journalist walked into the interview thinking, oh man, you know, Monica Lewinsky, we all know about her, manipulative, you know, she just was, you know, wanting the affections of the president, wanted to bring down the most powerful man in the world. At the end of it, I saw her very differently, and she actually became a very good friend of mine. And I really do believe it's because it was that trust that we had with each other in the way we presented the story, truthfully, honestly, and yet with some respect. So that was obviously a highlight that I had. But I think probably the biggest highlight of working at Oxygen was meeting Oprah. I had met her a couple of times, obviously, since she was heading up the channel, but she was still staying in Chicago to do her show, and we were based in New York. So one time she decided to come to New York and have a chat with all of us in smaller groups to see how things were going. So this was what happened during that meeting. The purpose of the meeting was for Oprah to get a better sense of what our show was doing and to consider ways to improve it. It was a chance for us to get advice from the best in the business, really a once-in-a-lifetime chance, so I wasn't going to squander it. I said that there were times when I felt conflicted as a host because of the way the producers approached a topic versus what I thought was more appropriate. I asked Oprah how a host can reconcile these two things and make the approach work. She replied, "It's all about intention. You should always ask yourself, what is the intention of this story or interview? What do you want to get out of it? What do you want the audience to get from it? If the right intention is there, then the story will be what it should be and will somehow make a difference, an impact." As I sat listening to Oprah, who was looking at and speaking directly to me, for a moment, everything sort of froze. It was surreal. Here I was getting personal advice from Oprah Winfrey on how to be a better TV host. I couldn't really believe my good fortune. Her advice has always stayed with me, and to this day, I think about intention before, during, and after anything I do, both on and off television. It's a great philosophy to live by, and it keeps things focused and true. After several years at Oxygen, I decided to take a leap of faith and follow something that I'd always wanted to do, which was live for a better lifestyle. All these years I had worked so hard as a journalist, just moving from place to place and, you know, not having a choice of where I was going to go, and I was only going because of the job. But I had wanted to go back to California, which is where I went to school, because it's where I feel like I belong. I have this affinity with that state, and I wanted to move there. So I decided to leave Oxygen and move to LA. Luckily, though, another network came knocking and asked me to be a correspondent for them based in LA. It was ABC News. So I took it thinking, okay, well, you know, nice balance of a job and a place where I wanted to live. It was back to news again. So in California, I don't know if you all know, most of the news is either about natural disasters like wildfires or earthquakes, or it's celebrity-driven scandals. And remember, I was working for the network, so this is supposed to be legitimate network news. So one night, I get a call from my bureau, and they say, "Drive up to Santa Barbara to Neverland Ranch. Michael Jackson has been accused yet again of child molestation. You got to go do some live shots." We knew very little about this story. That's all we knew, is that somebody had accused him of sexual molestation again. So we drive up there in the middle of the night, and it is a media circus, of course. In the dark, everybody is set up with their live bands and their trucks and trying to cover the story that was almost non-existent because, again, there were hardly any facts, no information. And so this is when I had a moment. That's when it all hit me, as if Michael Jackson's glittery glove had slapped me upside the head. I looked around me and saw the frenzy that this overhyped story was creating. I noticed down the street a few reporters from the glitzy entertainment and tabloid television programs. They were doing exactly what I was doing, covering exactly the same story. It was a light bulb moment for me. I thought to myself, what am I doing? Is this what all my hard work in this business has led me to, covering a story about an eccentric, nearly noseless pop star? When the world is full of issues and people that really matter and should be given a platform on TV, why am I standing here in the middle of the night outside Neverland Ranch? And that was it for me. It was so clear that I was not doing what I was passionate about, that didn't have the fulfillment and meaning for me. And therefore, I decided I couldn't do this kind of television anymore. I took a break and then was lured back to Asia, to CNBC, moved to Singapore, thinking, all right, well, maybe there's a reason why Asia is calling me back. Started working for CNBC, but that was financial news. You know, it was all business. Not so inspiring to me, I will admit, completely. But what it did for me was that it did bring me back to Asia, and what I noticed right away after being away for 4 years was this change in women. The women of Asia had started becoming much more vocal, independent, outspoken, and they were really wanting some sort of outlet to be able to express themselves. I looked around and I noticed that there was no media representation of this newfound woman, this modern woman of Asia. And so I said to myself, well, you know, if nobody else is gonna do it, then I guess I'll do it. That's when I took the biggest leap of my life and I left my job to start my own company and become an entrepreneur in order to launch the Mei Li Show. Definitely wasn't easy though. And so this is when I launched my business. No one told me it would be like this. Starting a business from scratch is no walk in the park. It's more like trekking across the North Pole without a map, naked. To put it bluntly, sometimes it really sucked. But when it represents something that you believe in so strongly and with such deep, unending passion, then it's worth the blood, sweat, and tears. Even then, in the darkest days, when I really wanted to give up, it was passion and perseverance that got me through. Ask any entrepreneur who has stuck it out, and they will say that they never knew they were capable of such tenacity and strength of purpose. With the new business, I then sought out to launch this talk show. But again, when you're doing it on your own, you have to wear many hats. So I had to go out and try to raise money, find investors, find staff, convince sponsors to, you know, take the show, convince networks and distributors to distribute the program. The safety net was gone. I didn't have a staff of people. I wasn't backed by a corporation. It was just me. And that's where the fourth P comes into play, which is patience. Without patience, nobody can succeed, especially an entrepreneur, because you're faced with so many challenges and so many times where you just want to say, this is not worth it. Why am I going through this? The other thing that people don't talk about, and I always want to talk about and highlight, is when you go out on your own and take the risk, people don't talk about the dark side, which is the loneliness. The isolation. You know, you hear about the excitement of going out on your own and, oh my gosh, I'm so free to do what I want and I don't have to work for the man anymore. But you do have the loneliness factor. No support. Totally alone. And that is something that I wish more people would actually talk about and support each other on, because I think it's a crucial point that people should bring up. But patience is, you know, it is something that you need when you're trying to do something like I did. But, you know, I managed to cobble an investment together, enough money to launch the Mei Li Show, 13 episodes. Star World took it, and it was broadcast in 25 countries. So it was considered a success. But it was a risk for them, too, to take, because they had never seen the show. a show like this had never been done for Asia, so they had no idea how it would be received. I did the first season, but then Star World didn't want a second season. They told me they were going in a different direction, but we all know in television that's a euphemism for we didn't really want the show, so thank you, but no thanks. Obviously, it was a big disappointment for me because of all the hard work I had put into it. But let me read you something I wrote in my journal just because it really does truthfully state how I felt about this. I am one of the lucky few who can honestly say that I've lived out my dream. I remember saying to myself at the beginning of this project, May, even if the show doesn't go beyond the first season, you will be glad that you went for it and tried. I can tell you now that is exactly how I feel. Knowing that I rose above fear and insecurity and was able to pour my passion into the show for the women of Asia gives me a complete sense of accomplishment and at the same time, humility. I have no regrets about what I did. And if I had to do it all over again, I would do it again. Of course, I would probably do a few things differently, one of which is not think that I could do it all on my own. And I think as entrepreneurs, new entrepreneurs, we kind of think, oh yeah, I can do it, I can take care of it, you don't delegate enough. And that's the one lesson I definitely learned. I should have built probably a better team from the very beginning in order to make this happen on a bigger scale. But would I have changed my decision in breaking out and taking this leap of faith? No way. Because when you do something that you care about so much, believe in so much, kind of doesn't matter what the outcome is because it feels so good to be doing something that you care about and is your baby. And I really did feel like I had given birth. So I want to leave time for Q&A, so let me leave you with this one quote. Let me just say this before. I'm working on several different media projects as we speak, but don't get me wrong, I have had failures along the way, continued, some successes along the way, and I know that's just gonna be the way it is in this path that I've chosen. But with every experience, I learn something new and I say, all right, time to move on. But let me give you this quote because I love it so much and it really kind of, it's the best, most thoughtful ways in which purpose and meaning has been described. Meaning is not something you stumble across, like the answer to a riddle or the prize in a treasure hunt. Meaning is something you build into your life. You build it out of your own past, out of your affections and loyalties, out of the experience of humankind as it is passed on to you, out of your own talent and understanding, out of the things you believe in, out of the things and people you love, out of the values for which you are willing to sacrifice something. The ingredients are there. You are the only one who can put them together into that unique pattern that will be your life. Let it be a life that has dignity and meaning for you. If it does, then the particular balance of success or failure is of less account. So there you go, that's my story. And now, oh yeah, that'd be better.
Thank you very much, May. Now we'll take some questions. Simon has the microphone. Please introduce yourself with your name clearly so that we all know who's asking the question.
I think so, yeah. Oh, come on, there must be some questions. Yes?
Hi, my name is Liz Kim. I'm from South Korea's Yonhap News Agency.
Ah.
It was really inspirational.
Thank
you so
that.
Much for the speech. So, what is your future plan?
What is my future plan? Well, as I was saying, I've been working on a couple of different media projects. Some have failed and others are still in the works. But what I really do believe in is the next wave of media, well, not next wave, it's actually happening as we speak, is sort of the online environment. And I have yet to sort of really establish myself in that manner. I feel like content is being processed that way, consumed that way. And the beauty of what's happening now in media is that, you know, consumers, viewers, readers are the ones who are now in control, right? They can get what they want, when they want it, how they want it. So we as content providers have to now adhere to those demands and try to create a platform that allows for that interaction and that on-demand, you know, desire. So I would like to take what I've started in the women's space and really try to create an online presence that is unique in itself, because I think right now a lot of online sites are still a little bit two-dimensional. There's a lot of texts and articles and things like that, but if there could be more use of interaction, the social media that's growing, you know, so dramatically, and it's very focused to the audience that I'm wanting to speak to, again, women, I would very much like to try and create a space that makes sense and represents what I believe in, again, that passion. So that's kind of the direction I'm going in. I would love to continue writing more if I can, but you know, that will come in due time. And I always say this to everyone, when you have successes and failures like I have had in my time as an entrepreneur, it can be, you know, it can be very difficult. It can be humiliating at times and sort of frustrating. But what it really has done for me that's so positive is it has let me be much more open to opportunities that I never would have considered if I were still part of an establishment. Because, you know, when you're in a nice job in a nice company, it's very comfortable, right? You don't really have to push the envelope much. But when you're on your own, you really have to think so out of the box and consider things maybe you would have never considered in your previous life. Yeah, I mean, who knows? You might find me on somewhere, somehow, in something that maybe you never would have thought. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Anita Agee. And whenever we see you on TV, you always, you know, of course, you're very serious doing your job. But what's the funniest thing that's happened to you?
Oh, gosh, so many, actually. Well, I'll share two stories. When I was a young anchor in Dayton, Ohio, I had a much older co-anchor, Carl Day, who really didn't like the fact that I was this young Asian girl sitting next to him at the desk. But so I think he may have done this subconsciously. But in our studio, it was such a cheap, rundown studio that we had to keep the doors open because in the summertime because there was no AC. It was so hot. So bees would fly into the studio, right? And we're doing live news, so there's a bee flying around when we're trying to do the show. So at a commercial break, we had these fly swatters, okay? So we bring out the fly swatters, we're trying to whip this bee, and at one point the bee, I guess, landed on me. And so my co-anchor decides to try to swat the bee on my back. So I'm leaning over, and he's swatting me on the back, and we go back to live. And he literally is swatting me with the fly swatter, and we're on television. And we both just see the red light, and we're like, welcome back. I mean, it was silliness. It was outright silliness. Another story was when I was interviewing Eartha Kitt, who has since passed. And she was a very famous chanteuse and actress in the U.S. But she was horribly mean. I mean, she was, I've never interviewed somebody so just outright mean and bitchy, sorry to say. So we sat in silence before we went on the air, and it was the longest 3 minutes of my life. And my producers in my ear are trying to just, they're like, oh, are you having fun yet, May? Are you having fun? You know, and I'm trying to keep a straight face. And she literally was just sitting here like with the biggest scowl on her face. And I said, this interview was going to be a complete flop. Camera turns on, and she just turns into this unbelievably dynamic woman, and she's kicking up her legs in the chair, and I mean, I went with it, but it was literally the biggest sort of night and day experience I'd ever had on television with somebody. She's quite a character, so I could go on. I mean, I have so many stories, but you know, I'll get to other questions, but yes.
Hi, my name is Soojin. I haven't had a chance to see any Mei Li show because we don't have TV in our house. So could you give us examples of who you've interviewed and what kind of questions?
Yeah, we had a variety of guests, which was my point of doing the show. You know, each show had a theme. So for instance, the debut show was called The New Woman of Asia. So I tried to highlight women from different, you know, backgrounds who sort of represented what I thought was, you know, kind of this modern woman of Asia. So one of my guests was Joan Chen, who obviously had a very successful acting career, but then she became a director, producer, she's a mother, and she sort of encompassed, you know, a woman who kind of was able to sort of do it all. And she admits, just like a lot of women say, you can have it all, you just can't have it all at once, right? So she kind of shared the challenges she had gone through. Another woman I interviewed was a breast cancer survivor on that show, so, you know, she had conquered, you know, that, but then she went and climbed Mount Everest. I mean, so that was one show. Another show was about the new single women of Asia, because obviously we see that more and more Asian women are staying single for longer because they have found this new independence. So we featured a couple of different entrepreneurs who had made these decisions to break out on their own. One of the best shows that I did, though, that was probably the most fulfilling, was one that was called Change Makers. So we were highlighting social activists throughout Asia. So one woman was helping with microfinance in India. Another woman was helping the underprivileged in India, as well as leprosy patients. Another woman was saving elephants in Thailand. A man I featured was John Wood from Room to Read, who helps build schools and libraries. And I have to say, that show was one of those, you know, tearful shows where everybody in the studio audience was crying, and I was too on the air, just because it was so moving. And it did tell me, you know, this is the kind of television that should be done if we can do more of, because it made an impact. It made people think. It highlighted people who would never get that kind of attention for the work that they do. So yeah, we did a show that was called All About Sex in Asia. And that was the first and only time in my entire journalistic career that I was censored in Singapore. Yeah, so we know about that. 46-minute show, I had to cut out 15 minutes. That's a very big chunk of a show. So they didn't like some of the sexual content, and it was nothing flagrant, I mean, obviously. Yeah, I had no choice, so we had to edit out a big chunk. But, you know, we took risks. Had to.
Okay, let's have one more question, please.
Come on, make it a good one.
Over here?
You put me on a spot. There's a good one. I don't know.
Oh, okay. That's okay.
My name is Joe Bindi. I'm a journalist. I was a journalist. It's interested to know, learn that NHK hired you, knowing you were Korean.
Yes.
Did you experience any evidence of prejudice because you're a Korean in Japan?
That's a really good question. And actually, I write about a story about that particular theme. Yes, I did. NHK, I thought, was, yeah, very bold to hire me. You know, but I think they saw me more as a Western journalist of Asian descent rather than just Korean. But I did experience sort of the Japanese kind of old world attitude at one point. I was sent out to interview the chairman of a very large company in Japan. I walk in with my Japanese producer, and he looks up and says, "Where's the reporter?" Because he expected a man, first of all. And then she said in Japanese, "Oh, well, she's the reporter." And, you know, I could see he wasn't very happy about that. So we sat down, and then, you know, he said, "Well, why can't she speak Japanese?" And I had just arrived in Japan, so I didn't know any Japanese at the time at all. And so, unfortunately, my producer said, "Oh, but it's because she's Korean." The guy's face, I've never seen somebody's expression change so dramatically. The entire 30-minute interview, he stared at his shoe. He did not make eye contact with me one time, the entire interview. So, obviously, I wasn't very happy about it, but what could I do? I was infuriated, but I had to conduct the interview. I wanted to punch the guy in the face instead, but, you know, couldn't do it. So that was the one time where it was very blatant. Other than that, no. And, you know, I have to admit, NHK was actually very good to me, so it never made me feel that there was any difference. The bigger difference was being female. Because, you know, the Japanese bosses, they were all male. So the women on the staff were never asked to go out drinking after work, which is where a lot of business is done. And, you know, so the boys would go out. And so my male co-workers, you know, would get a lot of inside information that, you know, we did not as females. So.
Okay, well, I think we'd all like to say a big thank you to May for coming along, and she's getting the usual FCC gift of appreciation.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming.
Thanks so much for coming, everyone. I appreciate it. And yeah, like I said, the book launch is at Coast tonight if anybody wants to come from 7 to 9. Yeah.